Hello, fellow humans, and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host and fellow human, Andrew Heaton. I've had two experiences in my life in which I had to seriously think about robots. In 2008, I lived in California for about half a year. I was trying to get into radio, but I paid the bills at the time working as a background extra on TV shows, and I lived in a tool shed behind my best friend's house. A lot of those shoots had very early start times, so one morning I left the shed around 6 a.m., and I walked to my car, and I saw this guy rooting around the dumpster outside of our house, and when we locked eyes, he said, "Good morning," like a robot. And I thought, if I were Google, and I wanted to test androids out for kinks, I would make them look like hobos. So if they started malfunctioning, people would just shrug it off and not think about it. Good plan, right? Now, within a year of that, I had left that tool shed and I'd gone to D.C. to work for the United States Congress. My job at the time mostly consisted of getting yelled at by old people, many of whom thought I was a robot. So I'd pick up the phone and go, "Hello, you've reached Congressman Dan Boren's office. How may I help you?" And then some other guy on the other line would go, "Damn it, he's got a robot answering the phone. I hate robot answering systems." "Whoa, hold on. I'm not a robot. I'm a man. I've got a cup of coffee. I touched a girl one time. By any metric, I'm just a regular human." "Well, tell me this, Slick. If you was a robot who was programmed to think you was a man, how would you know?" Which brings us to the subject of Blade Runner. It's the topic of today's installment of Alienating the Audience, where I try to shake the audience loose by deep diving into the world of sci-fi. We'll talk about Blade Runner. We'll talk about Blade Runner 2049 and the novel which inspired both, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? By Philip K. Dick. But first, a quick word from our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Necktie Lubricant from Wunderkim Industries. Well, it's that time of year, dry tie season. Every time you fasten a double Windsor around your neck, it's like you're cinching corn husks. And how embarrassing when you're out on a date and your necktie looks like it's been dragged through the desert. You're probably going home alone there, buddy. Fortunately, there's Necktie Lubricant, a helpful, viscous lubricant that has the delightful consistency of Crisco vegetable shortening. Just one handful is more than enough to keep your moist, smooth, and silky necktie perfect. And it's not just stylish, it's also very practical. Let's say you're leaning over your garbage disposal after work and you lean in a bit too far, and that tie drops in and gets stuck in the gears. Well, if you've got a dry tie, you're basically wearing a noose. But if it's well lubricated, you can squirm your way out, kind of like a raccoon. Thanks, Necktie Lubricant. Or what if you're on a lifeboat and the lifeboat is too full and you have to shove someone overboard for the good of the survivors, but they reach over and they grab you by the necktie, one of these guys that you knock off the boat. If your necktie is bone dry, Clingy McClingerson is going to have a death grip on you and pull you right into the soup with him. But if your necktie has been properly moisturized, he'll slide right off. And probably on top of that, if you just use a paddle once or twice, it'll be sufficient. I don't want to get into the subject of autoerotic asphyxiation, but I have to think it's one of many situations in which having a slippery knot, as opposed to a dry one, could spell out the difference between close call and very embarrassing tabloid death. So be sure to pick up yourself a jar of Necktie Lubricant from Wunderkim Industries. Necktie Lubricant. Look sharp, feel slick. My guest today is Ben Domenech. He is the founder and publisher of The Federalist. Ben, thank you for being on.
Great to be with you, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm excited about this.
Me too.
Yeah, you let me know you were coming through town. You're like, "Hey, I'm going to be in Texas. Do you want to? Could I come on your show?" And I was like, "Yeah, 100%. And then you're like, "You want to talk about Blade Runner?" Yes. This is phenomenal. This is exactly what I want to talk about.
So I gave you two options, Heinlein or Blade Runner.
Yeah.
But Blade Runner makes more sense because it does take place in the far off distance future of 2019.
Of now. That's right. We are living in the Blade Runner reality right now.
Totally, yeah. Except without the flying cars.
And you've got a Blade Runner. You're a fan of it. You've got like an early copy or something like that.
Yes, I have. I have a 1982. It's not a first edition, but the sixth edition tie-in copy with the cover and all the stuff. I actually was rereading it and I was rewatching it as preparation for our session today. And Lots of different things to talk about with this movie.
Perfect. Yeah, so out of curiosity, did you read the book first or did you watch the film first?
I read the book first. Nice. Because I was a voracious reader, as Garrison Keillor identified. You can always tell a reader because they don't know how to pronounce things. So they read words and they think it's pronounced something like Egyptian. But
thank you.
But it's one of these things that, you know, for me, I just kind of went through the whole Philip K. Dick catalog and then only came around to see the movie when I was a teenager.
Wait, how many Philip K. Dick novels did you read before you saw the movie? Because I feel like if you read more than three Philip K. Dick novels in a row, that's the same as an acid trip. Because they are I would say if I could pick one theme for Philip K. Dick, it's reality isn't real.
Yes.
That's his main thing. So I will not read him. But like for the same reason I don't like reading Kurt Vonnegut back to back because I get too depressed. I can't read Philip K. Dick back to back because then I question whether or not I should like leap out a window or something.
So Philip K. Dick obviously inspired so many different films that people are familiar with, but they may not know them by a different. They may know them by a different title. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, Total Recall is We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are lots of other different novellas that show up. He obviously is the originator of Minority Report,
right.
and a number of other things. Man in the High Castle was the one I came to late because I tried it when I was younger and I couldn't grok it the way that I needed to. So that one I had to circle back around to. But yeah, I binged a bunch of that stuff.
It's a fun read. My problem with, I shouldn't say my problem with, I think the thing about Philip K. Dick, which can add a little bit of, it makes it harder to get into it, is that Philip K. Dick has kind of the same format for everything from what I can tell, where there's the central premise. So like Man in the High Castle, the central premise is that we're living in an alternate universe in which the Nazis won. But also, there's like a Chinese numerology system that can predict the future.
Yes.
And that's always like Philip K. Dick. It always has like this central thing where you're like, oh, cool. Like we're on a moon base and there are detectives. And he's like, yes. And dogs are psychic. Like there's always this like weird small thing going on. And that was one of the things with that. Philip K. Dick is the go-to. Whenever Hollywood runs out of science fiction, they're like, can you just like crack open some weird science fiction magazine and find like an 8-page story that Philip K. Dick wrote in 1972? And they're like, yep, cut out the bit about psychic dogs. Focus on the moon base detective story, and then we'll launch into that. Yeah,
and that's why he's perfect for an environment like this, where people are desperate for IP and they mm-hmm. want to be able to make interesting content. And I think it's why people return to the well so much. He's also somebody who I think, as trippy as he is, there's almost always some fundamental lesson or philosophical debate that's underneath it, but it doesn't become the animating focus of the story, which is the problem that I actually have with Isaac Asimov, where it often feels like to me he's more interested in the puzzle than he is in the plot. So here's a logic problem, but I'm disguising it with this, that, and the other. With Dick, I think you actually have some, you know, a greater ability to take different aspects of it and pull them out and sort of say, oh, well, let's just tug on this thread of it and get to something there.
He's a lot more ponderous and introspective. I mean, I grew up, I probably read Asimov before any other science fiction author. I read a lot of Asimov when I was a kid. I loved his robot stories.
Yes.
But Asimov, while I adore that author, every single one of his characters is completely interchangeable with every other character because they're all competent engineers. There's no distinction between them.
Totally.
There's like one book, I think the gods themselves were like one of the engineers is petty, and that's the only time ever. Whereas like Robert Heinlein, which we almost talked about, Robert Heinlein, I love his books, but he has like basically four alternating archetypes. There's the witty guy who gets laid. There's the young woman who is in love with him, but also completely accepting of his sexual license. In every book I've ever read, Robert Heinlein always has those two, and
totally.
then he's got a couple of others. And then I feel like Philip K. Dick it's always this interplay of reality. The ladies in his books, I feel like, are usually vicious. Mm-hmm. Like they're usually like there's a lot of psychoanalysis they'll bring in where they'll be having this random conversation. They're like, you know what, your problem is you're a narcissist with schizophrenic tendencies, and that's why you're such a horrible person. And then he'll fall in love with them, which is this kind of so the characters are vicious. But Philip K. Dick also very much more introspective and ponderous, and also a lot more metaphysical mm-hmm. in terms of trying to question like what is the nature of reality, what's the morality informing all of these things. Whereas like Isaac Asimov is, wouldn't it be cool if there were robots? What would happen if we had robots and there was a detective story?
Yeah, I find Philip K. Dick to be fascinating for a number of different reasons. But in this context, you know, the film Blade Runner has such a unique, bizarre, odd history for something that became, you know, that was you know, not a success, but then became this cult movie with so many different adaptations, so many different spins on it. And, you know, again, to return to this idea, you can take a lot of different themes out of it and apply it in different ways to mythology, to, you know, to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, mm-hmm. to lessons about creativity and sort of the corrupting nature of that, and also, frankly, to concepts about having a future, having an ability to reproduce and to you know, have sort of a species that are, you know, part of other sci-fi, you know, generally, you know, if you think of something like Children of Men, mm-hmm. but is, I think, really uniquely dealt with in this story in ways that, you know, speak to kind of the lasting power it's had over people's consciousness.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. What, like, so let's start with Blade Runner, because actually I can't say that most people listening to the podcast have, I suspect actually most people that are still with us at this point, Ben, have read the book and the podcast and are already writing me an email about how I bungled something about Isaac Asimov. So we're in deep nerd territory here. But let's go ahead and start with Blade Runner, because I think the bulk of the population is probably more familiar with that than with the book. So what are the themes that strike you in the film of Blade Runner?
So there are a number of different ones. Obviously, there's the desires to meet your maker. The different elements that are going on here include, of course, the fact that you have these replicant creatures who are created who have a built-in failsafe, a finite and limited lifespan, mm-hmm. And that you have a number of them who've gone rogue, who, you know, are need to be retired. In this case, you're essentially going and killing these humanoid creatures who have, you know, frankly, a desire to live. They've crossed that threshold from being a robot into being something that thinks of itself as human. I don't know that you I don't know if you're a fan of Rick and Morty, the show that's Adult Swim, but there's a particular moment which is often memed.
Hold on, Ben, let's just quit our jobs and just do, you and I will do a science fiction podcast. We've already talked about Asimov, we've talked about Rick and Morty, we've got, like, you just mentioned Children, we could totally make this a thing. We could totally do this. We have enough fodder.
So there's a scene in Rick and Morty which is often memed, so I think people, even if they haven't seen the show, might be familiar with it, which is Rick, the inventor, is sitting at a table, and the butter is out of reach. He's having breakfast, and he just sort of pulls some things out of his pocket and sort of smacks together this tiny little robot, which has, like, a little you know, undercarriage on it and has these little arms, and the robot sort of wakes up and looks at Rick and says, "What is my purpose?" And Rick says, "You pass butter." So the robot goes over and picks up the butter and brings it over to Rick, and Rick, you know, takes the butter. "Thank you." And then the robot says again, "What is my purpose?" And he says, "You pass butter." And it looks down at its sort of hands and goes, "Oh my God." And then Rick says, "Welcome to the party, pal." And it's just like that. That's what sort of Blade Runner is on a certain level of it's these creatures who are recognizing that they have certain roles they're supposed to fulfill. You know, when they're introducing them in the beginning to Harrison Ford, it's this is a typical pleasure model. This is a typical sort of,
it's like a combat type thing,
you know, type thing. And that just sort of the idea of these are humanoid creations that are built to fulfill one purpose, and that purpose is not to continue to exist or to regenerate or to have children or anything like that. It's just to do this thing. But that creates a very difficult tension between them, their creators, and the world that's around them.
That's great. I had not thought about that. I'm glad that I invited you on. And I like that, too, because I feel like Philip K. Dick in the book has these religious motifs in it, mm-hmm. That I did not pick up on Blade Runner, although I think you're right about that. That is, there's the kind of surface-level motivations that the replicants have, which is that they want to, you know, the built-in fail-safe is that they're only going to live like 4 years.
Yeah.
And they want to have that lifespan extended, but wanting to meet the maker as well, and then eventually, like, sort of confronting each other. And I feel like we can do spoilers at this point.
Since
it came out in, like, 82, I think.
Yes, it did.
Maybe earlier. You know, at the end, I believe Roy, like, basically after having fought Decker the whole time, Decker's about to die, and he, am I thinking that he does save him at the
end? Yes, he saves him at the end.
Okay, yeah. And so there's this empathy, which I think empathy is the main thing for the books.
So the book is very different from the film. Mm. And really, just to put this in context, Ridley Scott, you know, the famous director of Gladiator and Alien and everything like that, he's just starting out at this point, and he's made The Duelists in 77, and he's made Alien, which obviously changed so many different things in terms of depicting sci-fi horror. Interestingly enough, he had wanted to make Tristan and Isolde before he decided to make Alien instead, which is kind of a different track.
Yeah.
Had he gone on that? And then he decides to make Blade Runner. He does it with Harrison Ford, who's obviously super popular actor at the time. And he makes this incredibly influential cyberpunk noir creation, the people know, I mean, the sort of the synth music and all the other things that are part of it. You know, he has, there's some key character actors who are in it, people like Edward James Olmos and others.
Who, by the way, still looks haggard, even though it's young James Olmos. Because, like, I was watching that earlier today. I didn't finish it to the pivotal scene, hence I had to ask you about that. But I was watching it earlier today, and I was like, is that James Edward Olmos? Because I know him from Battlestar Galactica. I'm like, he's haggard but skinny. That's the only difference. Haggard. Is he just came out old, and then he just sort of, he widened. He never really lengthened.
And we could talk about his origami fetish, too. Mm-hmm. But I have met someone who was in Blade Runner, and I had forgotten about it, and then I was reminded of it because I was watching the final cut of Blade Runner, which is the edition that they released in 2007, which we can talk a little bit about that. But the Asian character actor who is the eye maker, that is James Hong, and you recognize him even if you didn't yet from a number of key scenes. He is most influentially, he is the loyal butler in Chinatown who exports I can't get into spoilers for Chinatown, I guess, now. but he plays a pivotal role in the plot. But more importantly, he is the maitre d' from the episode of Seinfeld, the Chinese restaurant, where they spend 23 minutes waiting to be called. And he's Seinfeld, party of four, or whatever, at the very end. And I once met him while he was wandering around lobbying on behalf of some, I think, actually religious group in Washington, D.C., and he was looking for a particular office. And while I was a staffer there for Texas Senator John Cornyn, ran into him, recognized him, but had no idea what his name was. I mean, why would you know who this character actor is? And directed him and was like, that's the guy from the Seinfeld Chinese restaurant thing. And lo and behold, he's in this too.
Nice. So, well done. You've touched greatness. Yeah.
Yeah. But just to circle back to the question about sort of these differences, is Ridley Scott does all sorts of weird things with this movie. He options the script, which is ends up being written by David Peoples, who also was far more famous for later writing Unforgiven. But he doesn't like the name, because as with so many other Philip K. Dick things, it has very long.
Yeah, because Philip K. Dick, like, he loved writing these weird clunky Three Stigmata of Elmer Paldrich, like things like that.
And so he also options this William S. Burroughs book, which is also sci-fi, but about like running medical devices. I have read it, but I've forgotten the plot. That's called Blade Runner, just because he wants the name.
Wait, so it's not even a Philip K. Dick title?
Nope.
I see. I just assumed that was a Philip K. Dick short story, and they were like, well, we'll take a little bit from column A, take a little bit of column B.
He took it from William S. Burroughs, and he just took paid the option just so he could steal
the name.
Shots
fired at William S. Burroughs, your biggest contribution at this point, like in 2019, is having your title poached by another science fiction franchise.
But the casting of Harrison Ford was very fraught, and they looked at all sorts of different actors. I mean, everybody from Sean Connery to Arnold Schwarzenegger, they even looked at one point. He ended up doing Total Recall.
That was the law at the time. Yeah, it was a Philip K. Dick novel. It needed to be Arnold Schwarzenegger.
But they ended up with Ford, but they always knew that they wanted Rutger Hauer for Roy Batty. Mm. That he was just perfect from their perspective for this character. And
he looks like if IKEA were trying to make an Aryan Superman. Like, he's got that like very like highly symmetrical manufactured look.
He still says that's one of his favorite. He actually says it is his favorite performance. Mm. But he ends up being the star of this movie in a much bigger way than Ford is, I would argue. And in particular for the speech that he gives at the end of his life, which he changed significantly from what was originally supposed
really
to
what
be
were they going
to
have him do? Because he'd basically been a villain throughout the film, and then at the end of it, he saves Decker, and he, as I recall, makes this this thing about, like, you know, do you know what it's like, and like, you know, like, do you know what it's like to be made a slave, built as a slave? Yeah,
the you know, he talks about seeing the ships on fire off of Orion and the opening of the Tannhauser Gate, and says that all of this will be lost like tears and rain. And he gives this sort of Christ-like pose sort of thing at the end. And if you go back and read what the original is, and you can find it on Wikipedia and that kind of thing, it's not bad, but it's nowhere near as poetic and good. And the interesting thing about that is that so many of these iconic moments in sci-fi have an element where a particular actor makes a choice to argue that the line should be different. And to give you another one, Harrison Ford did that exact same thing in Empire Strikes Back. and you can find the text of this in the because they have it recorded of a debate on set with Kirshner and Kasdan where he's about to do the carbonite scene, and Ford's line in the script is Leia says that she loves him, and he says I love you too. And he says, I would not say that.
Yeah.
And so and so they eventually say, instead, he says, I know.
Yeah.
which is such a fundamental understanding of the character that it makes such a more powerful. You wouldn't even remember that scene if you just said, I love you
too.
No,
it'd be much more boilerplate. Yeah, yeah. I agree with you. And that, by the way, is the kind of gold you can anticipate on Ben and my sci-fi podcast that we're doing when we quit our jobs to live in a boxcar here in a few weeks. Yeah, I think you're right at all of those things. I look at the film and I mean, the film is very clearly like a noir detective film. It's got that kind of dystopian post-apocalyptic feel to it, although they don't really spell it out as much. You do get the impression that it's very smoggy. There is a kind of post-environmental collapse element to it, although they skip out on all of the stuff about animals, as I recall.
Yes,
which is a big thing. It's interesting too because Duandra's Dream of Electric Sheep is not like a really thick tome. There's a lot in it, but it's reasonably fast. And it's Duandra's Dream of Electric Sheep. I mean, I think the key thing for that is, again, with all Philip K. Dick, what is reality? Mm-hmm. But beyond that, he focuses on empathy quite a lot. And what does it mean to be empathetic as a human being? Can you be deprived of empathy as a human being? Can you be non-human and be empathetic? And that interplay between all of them all over the place. Animals factor in because in the world of Duandra's Dream of Electric Sheep, there's a dominant religion, Mercerism. There's a Wilbur Mercer, who's a kind of Christ-like figure, who died. He was stoned to death on a hill somewhere. And in this world, you can put your hands on a Mercer box, I think, and participate in that kind of collective euphoric masochism going on. But one of the things of Mercerism is that empathy is the sort of the top value. And therefore, if you have a relationship with an animal that you're taking care of, that's a good thing. However, that's problematic because we live in a post-apocalyptic nuclear wasteland. So people have electric sheep as a kind of like status symbol. This is the artificial lawn of the 21st century in his eyes.
So let me draw a comparison here to, it's like having cat videos without having a cat. Or in your case, it's like having dog toys without having a dog.
So the
thing that I think is so fascinating about that element of this, which is mentioned in passing in Blade Runner, but only in passing, like, oh, is your snake real? What do you think I am? You know, a rich person? You know, like, of course I can't afford a real snake kind of thing. That element of this is mostly absent in the film, though it is underlying in the sense that, like, what's the difference between the mechanical sheep and this mechanical person in front of me? Mm-hmm. Well, one of them can pass for being a human. One of them almost, you know, seems like it. But there is that innate human desire to care for domesticated animals or to have this kind of relationship with these lower life forms, as they are. And I think of it as being very comparable to the way that humans today are, you know, obsess over cat videos and that type of thing. It's a natural human emotion that on some level, indicates sort of our affection for these, you know, cute little kind of pointless things that separates us from the sort of fiercely logical, one direction only, I was made for combat, I was made to pass butter. Which
is Decker's initial understanding of the situation, because Decker, the character in the book, when talking about empathy and talking about humans, says that empathy is something only shared by omnivores and herbivores. He does not think that empathy exists outside of that narrow world, that a carnivore would have no sense of empathy. Now, I disagree with that because even though I don't own a dog, I do love dogs. Dogs clearly have a sense of empathy from where I'm coming from.
And obviously, clearly, no spoiler alert, but the last episode of Game of Thrones, the most human and empathetic moment in the whole thing was arguably achieved by a dragon.
Well, and I think that plays out in the book as well, because you've got various characters that are all figuring out how they come in. So in the book, you've got the setup for it is that we're living in post. I think it's set in 2019 as well, or it's early 21st century. We don't really know when it is, but it's after World War Terminus, and we don't really know who it's between. We know the Soviet Union's still around, but we apparently nuked everything. There's just this shroud of radioactive smog over the entire planet all the time, and most the planet's largely depopulated. There's a kind of intellectual hierarchy that exists because they reference like there's ant heads and chicken heads. Like your animal hyphen head signifies how smart you are comparatively, and they're pushing really hard to get anybody that doesn't have radiation damage to leave the planet because they want to create like a pure Homo sapien colony on Mars or something like that. So everybody's just kind of living in this post Chernobyl environment, the empathy comes in both with Mercer, but with also in terms of what's the proper role with these replicants. Well, the replicants are androids, but they're organic androids. They're not made out of bolts and plastic parts. They're literally organic, and they've been manufactured for these purposes to assist people off world. Decker initially has this idea of himself of like, no, I'm a good guy. I would never kill a person. I would never kill a human being. I just kill these robots that kind of look like human beings. But that's not an issue. And then as the book progresses, it's like, well, they seem to be pretty people-like. Mm-hmm. And then you have another character. I think it's Phil Raish, who's also human, but seems to kind of enjoy killing him. Like, for him, it's not even a living. He just kind of gets a kick out of killing people, and he's allowed to kill those people.
The action is the juice, yeah.
Right. and then there are these sort of expanding ideas of how empathy relates to you and the body that you're a part of. So the humans in this kind of this situation have a kind of collective empathy. The androids sort of have a binary empathy for each other occasionally, or maybe some of them do, where they can develop it. And then eventually Decker develops this empathy, and we find out that Rachel, who is in both both movies, and who Decker, or I'm sorry, the movie and the book, Decker falls in love mm-hmm. with both, is sort of this implant in the book that is supposed to seduce bounty hunters and make them fall in love with her so that they will not go kill more androids.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I want to throw this out. If you want to feel like you've done hallucinogenic drugs, just read the Wikipedia summary of any plot of a Philip K. Dick novel, because it looks insane. It's like then Rachel goes back to his house and pushes his electric goat off the roof to punish him for killing an android after he has sex with her after finding out she's an android. It sounds crazy, but it actually works pretty well.
It does actually. So a couple of points. I think, you know, one thing that we should keep in mind about the difficulty in adapting this is how many different things Philip K. Dick is trying to cram into.
Yeah, and he's doing a lot.
One thing that I think that the movie does very well in terms of taking kind of a shortcut is the obsession with eyes that is supposed to be indicative, in my view, of the matters of perspective. The perspective of this sort of dying creature that cannot reproduce, that only wants to meet its maker before it ends, versus the perspective of those that must hunt it. It has so many different elements of that crop up. You know, the doctor that I mentioned before, the scientist that they meet is the eye creator. The confrontation with Terrell is obviously includes that gross scene as well.
Yeah.
But it's one of these things where that I think is meant to be kind of a prism through which we view life, and that can be very different dependent within this world on where you emerge from. And so to speak to that, you know, sort of idea of people being viewed as of replicants being viewed as inhuman by people, that matter of perspective, I think, is something that Dick communicates in different ways. But Scott, I think, was trying to sort of do honor that in some ways. There are other ways in which Scott completely departs from the spirit of the book. Which is fine. I mean, you know,
To give him due credit, though, I think if you were going to turn it into a modern Netflix special or HBO special where you could actually do it over the course of 15 hours, you could probably cover all of this. If you're doing it in 2.5 hours, you can't like also have, you know, environmental degradation, post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Yep.
Is empathy purely human? Mind control, mercerism, like there's way too many. You got to pick one or two things and go with them.
And to give you just a sense of perspective on that, there is a very critically acclaimed video game that came out many years later that was sort of an adventure game across multiple discs that was basically you're another Blade Runner set within this universe that interacts with things that happen in places that happen to be in the film, but also tries to sort of include some of these other elements as well. But it's a massive game. Like it's so in all honesty, if you're trying to do this and have all these elements, you would have to have it be a miniseries or something like that, which is what they've done with some of the other Philip K. Dick productions at various
places. Man High Castle and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, so like one of the things that they don't talk about at all in the movie that I really enjoy is this kind of this dichotomy between Buster Friendly and Wilbur Mercer. So Wilbur Mercer, we mentioned him earlier, he's the Christ-like figure that's the progenitor of this new religion of empathy on Earth in this post-apocalyptic wasteland. Buster Friendly is like kind of a hyper Johnny Carson figure. He is on the, he's on TV, and I think he's on TV constantly. Like he does like 24 hours a day or something like that, which while they don't, I think one of the characters at one point brings up the fact he's almost certainly an android. And it kind of, you get the impression, my read on it is I almost feel like Philip K. Dick's talking about mind control.
Yeah.
And from Philip K. Dick's perspective, he sees the two competitions, at least in this particular venue, as mind control either from the mass media, where I guess I'm a player, or from religion. And it's why they're fighting in the book. And then I read the book, it blew my mind because I loved what he did there, where Mercer turns out to be false.
Yeah.
Like there's this whole report about a Buster Friendly, the Johnny Carson character, who's always taking pot shots at Mercerism. Goes, you know, we're doing an investigative expose, and turns out that Mercer isn't even a real guy. His name's like, you know, Phil Dapley, and he's this kind of down and out alcoholic that's living in a RV park in California. He made the whole thing up. And then after this happens, a guy gets a vision from, or Deckard gets a vision from Mercer. He's like, but I thought that was all fake. And he's like, it is fake. So it's sort of, it would be the equivalent of Jesus like showing up and like you meeting Jesus and him going, I made it all up. And you're like, but how? But that interplay again. I feel like that there are some deeper elements that he's dealing with there of religion, mind control, mass media, and all that kind of thing. What was your read on that?
You know, I absolutely agree with you, your interpretation there. I think that one of the things that we have to take away from this is, from Dick's perspective, I think, you know, he routinely is coming back to the ways that our minds are manipulated, but also the way that we agree to have them manipulated. And you can, you know, even if you haven't read I Can Remember It For You Wholesale, if you've seen Total Recall, you get the idea. You know, you can have this this kind of, this escapade adventure that's implanted in your head and that, you know, allows you to go and do all sorts of, you know, incredible things in your mind, but it doesn't, you're not actually doing them in real life. The folk rock singer Father John Misty, his not his most recent album but his previous one, he opens it by having this sort of it's a song called Total Entertainment Forever, where he says, where the opening lines are, betting Taylor Swift every night in the Oculus Rift. Okay, and I think that that's sort of what Dick is getting at, is this idea that we, not only do we sort of go along with having our minds manipulated by these major sort of entities, but we willingly allow it. We willingly give up our own sort of perspective on that, and are willing to sacrifice it in ways that ultimately can be proven to be very harmful. To another point, Futurama has this one video that I have referenced many, many times, which is it's sort of presented as like a not a sex ed video, but something like that that they force them
it's
to
the
watch.
Marilyn Monroe bot?
The Marilyn Monroe bot, yes. Where basically, you know, when you can download a celebrity consciousness into an android, into a robot, that is basically the end of humanity, because at that point, there's no longer any of the motivating factors that exist within society. They say it turns out that, you know, most of human history was entirely about impressing the opposite sex, and then they have all these things flying in the screen, and sometimes the same sex drama, and it turns out that that's like a destroying effect. To me, that's of a piece with all of this. It's like, if you live in a realm in which you have a pleasure model that can live for 4 years and then just goes away, you know, why deal with all the things that, you know, it's less expensive and they work for you. And that's, but at the same time, it's giving up your own humanity in order to do that. And you can reach a point where those robots seem more human than the humans themselves.
That's amazing. I very much enjoyed that. That was the best connection of Philip K. Dick and Futurama that I've heard this week. That was really good. Something that my producer Jennings and I have spoken about several times is whether or not we think that the world is moving more Orwellian or more Huxleyan.
Yeah.
And I feel like there are these very stark differences of dystopia, where Orwell is this totalitarian dystopia of, you know, North Korea Nazi type thing, where, you know, a boot smashing a face into the earth for all eternity. Whereas Huxley is, nope, you are going to be so overwhelmed with sex, drugs, and entertainment, you don't care. No one needs to actually force you to do anything because you won't want to do anything.
You know, I think they're both right, but they're right about different parts of the world. We have, you know, just this week, we've learned so much more about what, in a lengthy report in the New York Times, in other places they're getting out, about the mechanisms by which China is monitoring all the people they find problematic, particularly those who are religious, mm-hmm. and monitoring them to a degree that's being helped not just by their own technology, but by, in some cases, Western technology. And it's down to the level of, if you do particular things that are totally legal, you still get flagged by the system because they find a correlation. For instance, one of the examples that the New York Times used was, you have driven and refueled a neighbor's car, which is totally obviously
good
legal,
or bad.
But no, it's indicative of potential problems, you know, like that kind of thing. And that they flag things down to, you know, which cafes you go to and which items you purchase. So that's the Orwellian sort of side of things. But for the West, of course it's Huxley. Huxley is right about all these different things.
Our president's a game show host.
Yes. We embrace the soma of limitless on-demand streaming anywhere, anytime, and the only time we really get mad is when the Wi-Fi doesn't work.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, if that were, you know, if we were making a James Bond film today, what he would do to hold America hostage is have a machine that just shuts off Wi-Fi.
Oh yes,
like you
totally.
could even get email. You can still get email on your phone. It shuts off Wi-Fi for like streaming services, and that's it. And like Facebook,
and if you don't believe that, just check the Twitter feeds when HBO Now is down.
Like,
oh Lord.
So I'll kick a couple of philosophical questions to you, and then we'll get on to Blade Runner 2049. So we've been talking about replicants and makers. Do you think replicants have any moral obligation to their makers?
That's an interesting question. I think perhaps to a certain extent, but not to the extent that they're depicted as within this storyline. I think that, you know, it's sort of a, you know, honoring your father and mother does not extend to, you know, doing the ridiculous, you know, or the self-threatening, the self-harming activity. And I think inevitably with these types of creations, that's where things are going to go. That's where things are always going to end up.
I think if human beings could build other human beings to serve them, they would probably not be like indentured servants for 6 months and then like, hey, go get a community degree or go to college. Like, we're really rooting for you, former slave. I think human beings like to bring in Star Trek. There's an episode where Guinan is talking to Data, and she talks about how every civilization wants to have disposable people. Because disposable people are quite useful.
Can I actually ask you about that? Because so you know so much more about Star Trek The Next Generation in particular than I do. What do you see as the key differences between the way that Data is being such an iconic figure, mm-hmm. who is the closest thing, I would say, in this universe to one of the replicants that's depicted? What is the key difference there?
Oh, that's good. Well, I think a couple of things. I think that the replicants are... It's fairly similar to Battlestar Galactica in that they're ultimately basically just humans.
Yeah.
It's just that one human's line, the one that we're in, has been developed by evolution to reach where we're currently at, and another one was developed artificially but has the exact same effect. The Turing effect would pass. You know, in Blade Runner, they've got the
Voight-Kampff
test. But in terms of the actual differences, they're very, very human. They seem to have their own motivations. They seem to have their own feelings and that kind of thing. So, and the lesson from both is oftentimes that, like, really, when you get to that point, the distinctions themselves are artificial and meaningless. It's more to do with, I guess, the dignity of sentience, mm-hmm. and how you are going to treat someone else regardless of whatever their situation is.
But Data would never think of himself as a slave.
No, and Data's not treated as one except in one episode, well, two episodes. Data, I feel like, is much more of a Pinocchio stand-in.
Okay.
Where Data, because like the BSG or the replicants, they're just people that happen to be like, In the book, in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and in Blade Runner, in both instances, Rachel finds out that she is a replicant, and it's disheartening to her. It's terrible because it's here. All of my memories are apparently false, and I'm going to die in 2 years. Well, that'd be a tough thing. I thought I was from Oklahoma. I'm from Silicon Valley. And I've got 2 years to live. So they're basically people that have had the rugs ripped out from under them. Data is rather aspirational. He is starting out as a non-human artificial life form and is gradually, by choice, moving towards humanity and endeavoring to do so. His autonomy is rarely called into question. There's an episode where there's a fairly militant part of Starfleet that wants to disassemble him in order to mass produce Data's and have one on every ship. Ultimately Data and Picard save the day because, you know, it does not matter if your species is 1 or 20 or 20,000. The dignity of a species is from the, you know, whatever Patrick Stewart said. I'm sure I agree with it. And then I think there's another one where he's basically abducted by a toy collector who just wants him as a novelty. But that to me is the difference. This is what I'm getting at. Replicants and human beings in both universes are not fundamentally distinct from one another on any ontological level. They're genetically distinct, but they're not spiritually or existentially distinct. Whereas Data is a different thing. He is an other who wishes to move towards us.
Well, much of this has to do with the way that we analyze consciousness in these creations. This is not a sci-fi reference, but I am a fan of an old IKEA commercial, since you mentioned IKEA earlier, where they depict this sort of old lamp in a corner, and there's this sort of sad music playing and it's raining outside and someone, like, the lamp is sort of dimming and stuff, and then someone comes along and picks up the lamp and, like, sort of puts it in, like, a trash can thing and carries it out and puts it down on the street, and the lamp is sort of bent over and the rain is coming down, the sad music is playing, and that sort of gives you, like, a camera perspective as if you were the lamp, and in the corner where it was there's a new lamp, and then
why is IKEA making me feel guilty?
Wait, and then someone this man comes from off screen and he says, "Perhaps you feel sorry for this lamp. That is because you are stupid. It has no feelings, and the new one is much better." there's an element of that when you're dealing with robots on screen, of like, you know, these are creations that do not have. We fool ourselves we think that they, you know, have humanity, and yet, you know, there are so many kids out there who, you know, get worried when they see R2-D2 get zapped,
sure,
you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, like right now, like I own two Amazon Dots or Amazon Echoes in my house. And like, I like...
That's so unlibertarian of it, you.
Yeah. Well, hello, wiretap? Wiretap, play me some classical guitar music. I had this weird thing when I first got Amazon Echo where I watched some old British period piece. I don't remember what it was, but, you know, like upstairs, downstairs, something like that. And one of the local lord was just a complete dick to his staff. He's just really mean to them. And I was like, why would anybody? I have never gone to a Starbucks or to a Circle K or anything like that. Never spoken down to someone like that way. Alexa, play me some Electric Light Orchestra. No, not that one, you stupid trollop. How dare you not read my mind? Play a different one, you miserable clunking guts. And I was like, oh my God, is Twitter what's keeping me from being a monster? Is that I might just that's sad. They're also finding that with Amazon, they're it's having effects on etiquette with kids, because kids that have an Amazon Echo and they're like, play this. Like, well, that's fine. You can talk to it. It's a shoebox with wires in it. Yeah. It's okay. There's no actual. But they're then taking that and applying it to other people, which I think actually gets
dangerous.
Into like kind of like Platonic philosophy, if I'm not mistaken, that or Aristotelian philosophy of like, I'm going to do the thing not so much based on the effect, but on what it sculpts me into.
And then take that Alexa and put them inside the replicant,
mm-hmm.
and it's do this or do that, and often in ways that can speak to aspects of human nature that we might find, you know, more difficult. There are a few empathetic moments in sort of children's cinema involving a robot, you know, more sort of stunning, I would argue, than The Iron Giant, where the very end of that, you know, the hero, the giant that has been so close to the protagonist, you know, all along, sacrifices itself for the community, and that is not a giant that looks like a human or has much more, you know, sort of human elements to it, but But I've always loved the fact that when it's soaring through the sky at the end, it saw a Superman cartoon, an old Superman cartoon earlier in the movie. And you've got that deep, you know, low sort of voice that he says to nothing in particular, Superman. That's on a certain level, it's manipulative, but it's also sort of speaking to this idea that at a certain point, the creations of humankind will reach a level of sentience that has us raising questions about what is ethical within that environment and how these people are treated. And as with most things, I think that's probably going to come from the sex industry first. Yeah. We're going to have a lot of conversations about how you treat sex robots a lot earlier than I think we're comfortable having those conversations.
People are not, they don't acknowledge how much porn pushes the world forward. That would, like, you know, if it hadn't been for porn, it'd be a method by which we send emails after a nuclear apocalypse between Air Force bases. That would be what the internet is for. Yeah. No, I think you're right about that. That would make sense. Like that would, you know, like a sex
adjudicating,
bot or something.
Adjudicating how you treat the Pris model, which is, you know, mm-hmm. from the movie, would be something that sort of factors into that.
I do. I think that there will be a. I will hope that humanity will see the inner being of such entities. Asimov wrote an essay that I think he's got some insights on, where he says that he thinks that we would probably just relate to whatever looks like us most. So if you had like a clunky 1950s robot that had very similar programming to us that was indistinguishable, you know, over an audio speaker, we would not feel very comfortable with that. But if there were like a kind of dim-witted, very emotionally stunted being that nonetheless looked very, you know, very supple and organic and everything, that we would feel more close to that.
And this is one of the frustrations that I have, and I don't want to get off onto this tangent, but...
No, this is... I was just thinking, because this is probably like our sixth or seventh alienating the audience segment, and I wish we had a counter
ticker
at the bottom of extraneous references, because you would be winning this hardcore up to like 43. You're like, you know, that reminds me of the speech of Queen Elizabeth and the troops at Shrewsbury before the Spanish galleons came in, which actually followed quite well with Arthur C. Clarke.
Heart of a queen and a queen of England. The frustration that I have with Westworld. So Westworld is obviously inspired by Crichton, not by Dick, but to me, the interesting thing about Westworld when it first showed up, I have to admit, I just soured on it in the second season, was, all right, they're basically telling us a story about video games and how we should feel about treating sprites and other existent sort of things within video games, where they can die over and over and over again. They have no memory, obviously. You can reset. You can just go and do the thing again. And usually that type of thing is kind of played for laughs. But in Westworld, it's played as tragedy, that basically these sprite equivalents, who are basically replicants in terms of that they have some retained deep memory of what has gone on with them. So it's basically they are being raped and murdered and manipulated and treated horribly over and over again by these rich people who are playing to be, to use them as their own sort of park. And I got frustrated with it because I was just like on a deeper level, you know, this doesn't communicate to me, the way that I think it has the potential to do so, in part because I think maybe the people writing it don't play a lot of video games. But within the video game context, you actually do wrestle with these things as an ethical and moral matter. In Star Wars, The Knights of the Old Republic, there's a key moment where...
Reference number 57.
If you are playing evil, I mean, like, you have to make a very strong binary choice in that game about light or dark, okay? That you're going on the Sith path or you're going on the light path. And if you can dabble in one area or the other, but if you do it even a little bit too much, you know, kill the wrong person or do the wrong thing in a scenario, it can really damage your character. And so, but if you're playing it bad, there's a Wookiee in it who owes you a life debt, okay? And he has a little cute Twi'lek partner who's like his little sister sort of thing in terms of how he treats her. And there's a moment in the game where she rebels against you if you've done something particularly evil, and you can order the Wookiee to murder her. And that to me is like one of those moments in a game where if you do that, like without any hesitation, there's something wrong with you. Like even though these are just sprites, these are just, you know,
I'm gonna have
little
to
pixels.
Get up my old PC from 1998 and try and save all the Sims that I had working
exactly.
as stand-up comedians.
How
or
many lemmings
were,
have
they
we
doing.
Sent over the edge?
Oh. Hold on. So we're about to wrap up here in a minute, but we haven't actually got to Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So no, it's okay. I haven't. This is like the nerdgasm that you and I have shared has echoed through the entire galaxy. Like there are people on other planets going like, I feel very geeky right now. right now. What was that from? It's from us. But I do want to get your take on Blade Runner 2049. What did you think of it?
I loved it. I thought it was beautifully filmed. I thought it was cinematography was fantastic. I think it's very hard to do that kind of reboot, and it gives me a lot of hope for the Dune sort of reboot, which is coming from a team that includes a lot of the same people.
Are you trying to hit every science fiction reference before the end of the program?
I haven't said anything about if I say it, I break it. So the thing that there are a number of things I appreciate about it. I particularly like the scene where they're fighting and the Elvises are popping up, you know, here and there. Mm-hmm. But the dog is in it. That dog is in it, and that to me was sort of a nod to, we didn't have this animal element before. We want to have something like that, even if it's just sort of limited in this one. And I think that as a sort of modern sci-fi noir thing, having lived through the influences, I mean, The Matrix doesn't happen without Blade Runner. Okay, mm-hmm. All of these cyberpunk movies, they just don't happen without the original film. And I think that 2049 sort of took a lot of those elements and treated them in different ways. It's not as satisfying of a sci-fi movie as a lot of others that are out there. It subverts expectations at some key points. But I was impressed with it and thought it was very well done.
Wonderful. We have to end it there. Ben, I have enjoyed nerding out to the hilt with you so much. Thank you. I can't wait till we begin our new sci-fi program where we just do this ad infinitum. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Andrew.
A little bit of listener feedback before we wrap up the program. On YouTube, Will Granis says, is that a framed Ron Swanson behind you? And in response, A42 Wolves replies, our Lord and Savior. You can watch this whole show on YouTube. If you look for Something's Off with Andrew Heaton, you can see my handsome bearded face, Ben's handsome bearded face, the handsome bearded face of the buffalo between us, and, of course, the framed picture of Ron Swanson on the wall. Watching Something's Off with Andrew Heaton on your computer or phone is like taking the daily dose of vegetables you're always being told you should eat and dipping them in chocolate. So go to YouTube and start watching full episodes. I look like I built the love shack and then stocked it up with supplies in case of the zombie apocalypse. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. For those of you that have come this far, for those of you that have climbed the mountain nerd with me and Ben, don't you want to share this experience with other people? I'm sure you do. Well, in that case, please rate and review it. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you, and good day.